The guns were all gone, Warren said quietly, and the shot. We found the empty caissons where they had been stored. I would imagine they took the powder also. Certainly we did not see any left behind. All the long homeward journey along the coast was attended by the clouds of smoke and ruin, and preceded by their harbingers, the scorched and tattered ships, full of survivors, making their limping way back to safe harbour. The Allegiance did not attempt again to put in, relying instead on the Dragon's short flights to the coast to bring them fresh water, until 2 weeks more brought them to Cape Coast. Riley felt it their duty to at least make an accounting of the dead at the British port, and they hoped that the fortifications, older and more extensive than those in the other ports, might have preserved some survivors. The castle, which served as headquarters for the port, built in stone, remained largely intact but for the gaping and scorched roof. The guns, which had been useless to defend her, fixed as they were outward to sea, were all gone, as were the heaped piles of round shot from the courtyard. The Allegiance, being subject to the vicissitudes of the wind and current, could not keep the regular pace of dragons and had moved more slowly than the wave of attacks. 3 weeks at least had passed since the assault. While Riley organized the ship's crew in the sad work of exhuming and making account of the dead from their mass grave, Lawrence and his fellow captains divided amongst themselves the richly forested slopes north and surrounding the wreckage of the town, in hopes of ensuring enough game for them all. Fresh meat was badly needed, the ship's supplies of salt pork growing rapidly thin, and the dragons always hungry. Temeraire alone among them was really satisfied with fish, and even he had wistfully expressed the desire for a few tender antelope for variety's sake, or an elephant would be beyond anything, they are so very rich. In the event he was able to satisfy his own hunger with a couple of smallish, red-furred buffalo, while the riflemen shot another half a dozen, as many as he could conveniently carry back to the ship in his foreclaws. A little gamey, but not at all unpleasant. Perhaps Gong Su can try stewing one with a little dried fruit, Temeraire said thoughtfully, rattling the horns in his mouth in a horrible fashion to pick his teeth, before he fastidiously deposited them upon the ground. Then he pricked up his ruff. "Someone is coming, I think."
"For God's sake, are you white men?"
The cry came a little faintly from the forest, and shortly a handful of dirty, exhausted men staggered into their clearing and received with many pitiful expressions of gratitude their canteens of grog and brandy.
"We scarcely dared to hope when we heard your rifles," said their chief, a Mr. George Case of Liverpool, who, with his partner David Miles and their handful of assistants, had not been able to escape the disaster in time.
"We have been hiding in the forest ever since the monsters descended," Miles said. "They took up all the ships that had not fled quick enough, and broke or burnt them before they left again, and us out here with scarcely any bullets left. We have been ready to despair. I suppose they would all have starved in another week."
Lawrence did not understand, until Miles brought them to the makeshift pen concealed in the woods, where their last string of some 200 slaves remained.
"Bought and paid for, and in another day we should have had them loaded aboard," Miles said, and spat with philosophical disgust upon the ground, while one of the gaunt and starving slaves, his lips badly cracked, turned his head inside the enclosure and made a pleading motion with his hand for water. The smell of filth was dreadful. The slaves had made some attempt, before weakness had overcome them, to dig small, necessary pits within their enclosure, but they were shackled ankle to ankle, and unable to move far from one another. There was a running stream which emptied into the sea some quarter of a mile distant. Case and his men did not look thirsty, or very hungry themselves. There was the remnant of an antelope over a spit, not 20 feet from the enclosure. Case added,
"If you will take credit for our passage, we will make it good in Madeira, or," with an air of great generosity, "you are welcome to buy them outright if you prefer. We will give you a good price, you may be sure."
Lawrence struggled to answer. He would have liked to knock the man down. Temeraire did not suffer any similar pangs. He simply seized the gate in his foreclaws, and without a word tore it entirely from its setting and threw it down on the ground, panting over it in anger.
"Mr. Blythe," Lawrence said grimly, "strike these men's irons, if you please."
"Yes, sir,"
Blythe said, and fetched his tools. The slavers gaped.
"My God, what are you about?"
Miles said, and Case cried out that they should sue, they should certainly sue, until Lawrence, turning on them, said low and coldly,
Shall I leave you here to discuss the matter with these gentlemen?"
Which shut their mouths at once. It was a long and unhappy process. The men were shackled, one to another, with iron fetters, and in groups of four were fastened about the necks with rope. A handful of their ankles cuffed to thick billets of wood, which had rendered it nearly impossible for them to even stand. Temeraire tried to speak to the slaves as Blythe freed them, but they spoke a wholly different language, and shrank from his lowered head in fear. They were not men of the Tswana, but of some local tribe which did not have similar relations with dragons.
"Give them the meat," Lawrence said quietly to Fellows.
This gesture required no translation, and at once the stronger among the former captives began to arrange cooking fires, and prop up the weaker to gnaw upon the biscuit which Emily and Dyer distributed among them, with the help of Sifo. Many of the slaves preferred to flee at once, despite their obvious weakness. Before the meat was on the spit, nearly half of them had vanished into the forest, to make their way home as best they could, Lawrence supposed. There was no way of knowing how far they had been brought, or from what direction. Temeraire sat stiff with disgust as the slavers were put aboard him, and when they continued to murmur, turned his head to snap his teeth towards them and say in dangerous tones,
"Speak of Lawrence so again, and I will leave you here myself. You should be ashamed of yourselves, and if you have not enough sense to be, then you may at least be quiet."
The crew also regarded them with great disapproval.
"Ungrateful sods,"
was the muttered opinion of Bell, as he rigged out makeshift straps for them. Lawrence was glad to unload them again on deck and see them disappear among the rest of the Allegiance's passengers. The other dragons had returned with better luck from their hunting, and Maximus triumphantly deposited on the deck a pair of smallish elephants, of which he had already eaten three. He pronounced them very good eating, and Temeraire sighed a little, but they were earmarked at once for the celebration, which, though necessarily muted by their larger circumstances, could not be much longer delayed, and yet leave the bride in a state convenient to walking the deck of a rolling ship. It was a rather muddled occasion, although Chennery, with his usual fine disdain of any notion of polite manners, had ensured the sobriety of the officiant by taking Britain by the ear and dragging him up onto the dragon deck the night before, and instructing Dulcia not to let him stir an inch. The minister was thoroughly sober and petrified by morning, and Harcourt's runners brought him his clean shirt and his breakfast on the dragon deck, and brushed his coat for him on the spot, so he could not slip away and fortify himself back into insensibility. But Catherine had not thought at all of providing herself with a dress, and Riley had not thought at all that she would not have done so, with the result that she had to be married in her trousers and coat, giving the ceremony a very strange appearance, and putting poor Mrs. Grey to the blush, and several other of the respectable Cape Town matrons who had attended. Britain himself looked very confused, without the comforting haze of liquor, and stuttered rather more than less over his phrases. To crown the event, when he invited onlookers to express any objections, Lily, despite Harcourt's many reassuring conversations on the subject, put her head over the lip of the dragon deck to the alarm of the assembled guests, and said,
"Mayn't I?"
"No, you may not," Catherine said, and Lily heaved a disgruntled sigh, and, turning her lurid orange eye on Riley, said,
"Very well, then, but if you are unpleasant to Catherine, I will throw you in the ocean."
It was perhaps not a very propitious entry to the state of matrimony, but the elephant meat was indeed delicious. The lookout saw the light off Lizard Point the 10th of August as they came at last into the channel, the dark mass of England off their port bow, and he caught sight also of a few lights running past them to the east, not ships of the blockade. Riley ordered their own lights doused and put her on a southeast heading, with careful attention to his maps, and when morning came they had the mingled pain and pleasure of bringing up directly behind a convoy of some 8 ships bound unmistakably for Le Havre. 6 merchantmen and a couple of frigates escorting them, all lawful prizes, any of which would certainly have struck at once if only they had been in range. But they were a good 60 miles away, and catching sight of the Allegiance, they hurriedly pressed on more sail, and immediately began to run clear away. Lawrence leaned on the rail beside Riley, watching them go, wistfully. The Allegiance had not been scraped properly clean since leaving England, and her bottom was unspeakably foul. In any event, at her best point of sailing she did not make 8 knots, and even the frigate at the rear of the convoy was certainly running at 11. Temeraire's ruff was quivering as he sat up to watch them.
"I am sure we could catch them," he said. "We could certainly catch them, at least by afternoon."
"There are her stunsails," Riley said, watching through the glass. The sluggish frigate leapt forward, evidently having only waited until her charges had pulled ahead.
"Not with this wind," Lawrence said. "Or you might, but not the others, and we have no armour. In any case, we could not take them. The Allegiance would be quite out of sight until after dark, and without prize crews they would all run away from us in the night."
Temeraire sighed and put his head down again on his forelegs. Riley shut up his glass. "Mr. Wells, let us have a heading north-northeast, if you please."
"Yes, sir," Wells said sadly, and turned to make the arrangements.
But abruptly the frigate in the lead checked her way and bent her course sharply southward, with much frantic activity in the rigging visible through the glass. The convoy all were turning as if they meant to make now for Granville, past the Jersey Islands. Rather a poorer risk, and Lawrence could not imagine what they meant by it, unless perhaps they had caught sight of some ship of the blockade. Indeed, Lawrence wondered that they should not have seen any such ship before now, unless all the blockade had lately been driven up the channel by a gale. The Allegiance had now the advantage of sailing to head them off, rather than directly in their train. Riley said, "We may as well keep on them a little while longer," with studied calm, and put the ship after them, much to the unspoken but evident satisfaction of the crew, if only the other ship, which as yet they could not see, were fast enough. Even a single frigate might do, imbued by the near and awful presence of the Allegiance with greater force, and so long as the Allegiance was on the horizon at the climax of the chase, she should have a share in any prize taken. They searched the ocean anxiously, sweeping with their glasses, without success, until Nitidus, who had been jumping aloft at intervals, landed and said breathlessly, "It is not a ship! It is dragons!" They strained to see, but the oncoming specks were lost among the clouds nearly all the time. But they were certainly coming fast, and before the hour had closed the convoy had altered their course yet again. They were now trying only to get under cover of some French gun emplacement along the coast, risking the danger of running for a lee shore with the wind behind them. The Allegiance had closed the distance to some 30 miles.
"Now may we go?" Temeraire said, looking around.
All the dragons were thoroughly roused, and though crouched to keep from checking the ship's way, they had their heads craned up on their necks, fixed intently upon the chase. Lawrence closed up his glass and, turning, said,
"Mr. Ferris, the fighting crew to go aboard, if you please."
Emily held out her hand for the glass to carry it away. Lawrence looked down at her and said,
"When you are finished, Roland, I hope you and Dyer may be of use to Lieutenant Ferris, on the lookouts."
"Yes, sir,"
she said, in almost a breathless squeak, and dashed to stow the glass. Calloway gave her and Dyer each a pistol, and Fellows their harnesses a tug, before the two of them scrambled aboard.
"I do not see why I must go last,"
Maximus said petulantly, while Temeraire and Lily's crews scrambled aboard, Dalcia and Nitidus already aloft, Masoria and Immortalis to make ready next.
"Because you are a great mumping lummox, and there is no damned room to rig you out until the deck is cleared away,"
Barclay said.
"Sit quiet, and they will be off all the sooner." "Pray do not finish all the fighting until I am there,"
Maximus called after them, his deep bellow receding and growing faint with the thunder of their passage. Temeraire was stretching himself out, distancing the others, and for once Lawrence did not mean to check him. With support so near at hand, there was every reason to take advantage of his speed. They needed only to harry and delay the convoy a little while in order to bring up all the pursuit, which should certainly make the enemy shipping strike. But Temeraire had only just reached the convoy when the clouds above the leading frigate went abruptly boiling away in a sudden blazing eruption like cannon fire, and through the unearthly ochre glow Iskierka came diving down, her spikes dragging ragged shreds of mist and smoke along behind her, and shot a flamboyant billowing arc of flame directly across the ship's bows. Arcady and the Ferals came pouring after her, yowling fit for a nuisance of cats, and went streaking up and down the length of the convoy, hooting and shrilling quite in range of the ship's guns. But what looked like recklessness was not so, for they were going by so swiftly that only the very merest chance could have allowed a hit, and the force of their wings set all the sails to shivering.
"Oh,"
Temeraire said doubtfully, as they went dashing crazily past him and paused to hover.
Iskierka, meanwhile, was flying in coiled circles over the frigate, yelling down at them to strike, or she would burn them all up to a tinder, only see if she would not. And she jetted off another burst of flame for emphasis, directly into the water, which set up a monstrous, hissing pillar of steam. The colours came promptly down, and meekly the rest of the convoy followed suit. Where Lawrence would have expected the lack of prize crews to pose many difficulties, there were none. The Ferals at once busily and in a practised manner set about herding the prizes as skilfully as sheepdogs tending their flock, snapping at the wheelmen and nudging them by the bows to encourage them to turn their heads for England. The littlest of the Ferals, like Gurney and Leicester, landed on the ships directly, terrifying the poor sailors almost mortally.
"Oh, it is all her own notion,"
Granby said ruefully, shaking Lawrence's hand on the bow of the Allegiance. When that vessel had met them halfway, and travelling now in company, they had resumed their course for Dover.
"She refused to see why the Navy ought to get all the prizes, and I'm afraid she has suborned those damned Ferals. I'm sure she has them secretly flying the Channel at night, looking for prizes, without reporting them, and when they tell her of one, she pretends she has just taken it into her head to go in such and such a direction. They're as good as any prize crew ever was. The sailors are all meek as maids with one of them aboard."
The remainder of the Ferals were aloft, singing lustily together in their foreign tongue and larking about with satisfaction. Iskierka, however, had crammed herself in among the formation, and in particular had seized the place along the starboard rail where Temeraire preferred to nap. She was no small addition. Having gained her full growth in the intervening months since they had seen her, she was now enormously long and sprawling. The heavy coils of her serpentine body at least as long as Temeraire, and draped over anything which happened to be in her way, most inconveniently.
"There is not enough room for you," Temeraire said ungraciously,
nosing away the coil which she had deposited upon his back, and picking up his foot out of the other which was slithering around it.
"I do not see why you cannot fly back to Dover."
"You may fly to Dover if you like," Iskierka said, flicking the tip of her tail dismissively. "I have flown all morning, and anyway I'm going to stay with my prizes. Look how many of them there are!"
she added exultant.
"They are all our prizes," Temeraire said.
"As it is the rule, I suppose we must share with you," she said, with an air of condescension. "But you did nothing except come late and watch."
A remark which Temeraire rather instinctively felt the justice of than disputed, and he hunched down to sulk over the situation in silence. Iskierka nudged him.
"Look how fine my captain is,"
she added, to heap on coals of fire, and much to poor Granby's embarrassment. He was indeed a little ridiculously fine, gold-buttoned and beringed, and the sword at his waist also hilted in gold, with a great absurd diamond at the pommel, which he did his best to conceal with his hand.
"She fusses for days, if I will not, every time she takes another prize,"
Granby muttered, crimson to the ears.
"How many has she taken?" Lawrence said, rather dubiously.
"Oh, five, since she's set about it in earnest. Some of them strings like this one,"
Granby said.
"They strike to her right off as soon as she gives them a bit of flame, and we've not a great deal of competition for them. I do not suppose you know we've not been able to hold the blockade."
They exclaimed over this news with alarm.
"It is the French patrols," Granby said. "I don't know how, but I would swear they have another 100 dragons more than they ought on the coast. We cannot account for them. They only wait until we are out of sight, and then they go for the ships on blockade, dropping bombs, and as we haven't enough dragons well yet to guard at all hours, the Navy must stand ship and ship to fend them off. It is a damn good thing you've come home."
"Five prizes,"
Temeraire said very low, and his temper was not improved when they reached Dover, where upon a jutting promontory above the cliffs Iskierka now had a large pavilion made of blackened stone, sweating from the exhalations of her spines, and surely over-warm in the summer heat. Temeraire nevertheless regarded it with outrage, particularly after she had smugly arranged herself upon the threshold, her coils of vivid red and violet displayed to advantage against the stone, and informed him that he was very welcome to sleep there if he should feel at all uncomfortable in his clearing. He swelled up and said very coolly,
"No, I thank you,"
and retreating to his own clearing did not even resort to the usual consolation of polishing his breastplate, but only curled his head beneath his wing and sulked. Chapter 14. Hideous slaughter at the Cape. Thousands slain, Cape coast destroyed, Luanda and Benguela burnt. It will require yet some time before a complete accounting will render final all the worst fears of kin and creditors alike throughout these isles as to the extent of the disaster, which has certainly encompassed the wreck of several of our foremost citizens, for the destruction of many of their interests, and left us to mourn without certain knowledge the likely fate of our brave adventurers and our noble missionaries. Despite the territorial questions associated with the war with France, which lately made us enemies, the deepest sympathies must be extended now across the Channel to those bereaved families in the Kingdom of Holland, who in the settlers at the Cape Colony have lost, in some cases, all their nearest relations. All voices must be united in lamenting the most hideous and unprovoked assault imaginable by a horde of violent and savage beasts, egged on by the jealousy of the native tribesmen, resentful of the rewards of honest Christian labour. Lawrence folded the paper from Bristol and threw it beside the coffee-pot, with the caricature facing downwards. A bloated and snaggle-toothed creature labelled Africa, evidently meant to be a dragon, and several unclothed natives of grinning black visage prodding with spears a small knot of women and children into its open maw, while the pitiful victims uplifted their hands in prayer and cried, "Oh, have you no pity?" in a long banner issuing from their mouths.
"I must go see Jane," he said.
"I expect we will be bound for London this afternoon, if you are not too tired." Temeraire was still toying with his last bullock, not quite sure if he wanted it or not. He had taken three, greedy after the short commons of their voyage.
"I do not mind going," he said, "and perhaps we may go a little early and see our pavilion. There can be no reason not to go near the quarantine grounds now, surely."
If they did not bring the first intelligence of the wholesale disaster in Africa, having been preceded in their flight by many a swifter vessel, certainly they carried the best. Before their arrival, no one in England had any notion of the identity of the mysterious and implacable foe who had so comprehensively swept clean the African coast. Lawrence and Harcourt and Chennery had, of course, written dispatches describing their experiences, and handed them on to a frigate which had passed them off Sierra Leone, and to another in Madeira. But in the end these had only anticipated their arrival by a few days. In any case, formal dispatches, even the lengthy ones produced over the leisure of a month at sea, were by no means calculated to satisfy the clamouring demands of government for information on so comprehensive a disaster. Jane, at least, did not waste their time with a recounting of the facts. "I am sure you will have enough of that before their lordships," she said. "You will both have to come, and Chennery also, although perhaps I can beg you off, Harcourt, if you like, under the circumstances."
"No, sir, thank you," Catherine said, flushing. "I should prefer no special treatment."
"Oh, I will take all the special treatment we can get, with both hands," Jane said. "At least it will make them give us chairs, I expect. You look wretched." Jane herself was much improved from when Lawrence had left her. Her hair was shot more thoroughly with silver, but her face, better fleshed, showed all the effects of cares lightened and a return to flying, a healthier, wind-burnt colour in the cheek and lips a little chapped. She frowned at Catherine, who, despite a perpetual lobsterish colour from the sun, managed still to look faintly bluish under the eyes, and pallid.
"Are you still being taken ill?"
"Not very often," Catherine said, without perfect candour. Lawrence, indeed all the ship's company, had been witness to her regular visits to the rail aboard ship.
"And I am sure that I will be better now we are not at sea."
Jane shook her head disapprovingly.
"At 7 months I was as well as ever I have been in my life. You have not put on nearly enough weight. It is an engagement like any other, Harcourt, and we must be sure you are up to the mark."
"Tom wishes me to see a physician in London," Catherine said. "Nonsense," Jane said. "A sensible midwife is what you need. I think my own is still in harness, here in Dover. I will find her direction for you.
I was damned glad of her, I will tell you. 29 hours' labour," she added,
with the same dreadful reminiscent satisfaction as a veteran of the wars.
"Oh,"
Catherine said.
"Tell me, do you find—"
Jane began, and shortly Lawrence sprang up and went to interest himself in the map of the Channel, which was laid out on Jane's desk, striving rather desperately not to hear the rest of their conversation. The map was not as distressing in the visceral sense, although this was perhaps rather a sign of improper sensibility on his part, as the circumstances it depicted were as unfortunate as could be imagined. All the French coastline of the Channel was now littered with markers, blue representing companies of men, white for the individual dragons. Clustered around Brest there were 50,000 men at least, and another 50 at Cherbourg, At Calais, a force half that number again, and scattered among these positions some 200 dragons.
"Are these figures certain?"
Lawrence asked, when they had finished their exchange and joined him at the table.
"No, more's the pity," Jane said. "He has more. Dragons, at any rate. Those are only the official estimates. Powis insists he cannot be feeding so many beasts so close together when we have the ports blockaded. But I know they're there, damn them. I get too many reports from the scouts. More dragons than they ought to be seeing at a time. And the Navy tell me they cannot get a smell of fish, but they catch it themselves. The price of meat has gone so dear across the way. Our own fishermen are rowing over to sell their catches. But let us be grateful," she added. "If the situation were not so damned dire, I'm sure they would keep you in Whitehall a month answering questions about this business in Africa. As it is, I will be able to extract you without much more than a day or two of agony."
Lawrence lingered when Catherine had left. Jane filled his glass again.
"And you would do as well with a month at the seashore yourself to look at you," she said. "You have had rather a dreadful time of it, I find, Lawrence. Will you stay to dinner?"
"I beg your pardon," he said. "Temeraire wishes to go up to London while it is still light out."
He thought perhaps he ought to excuse himself. He rather felt that he wished to talk to her more than knew what he wanted to say, and he could not be standing there stupidly. She rescued him, though, saying, "I am very grateful to you, by the by, for the compliment to Emily. I have sent on to Powis at aerial command to confirm her and Dyer in rank as ensign, just so there should be nothing havy-cavy about the business, but there shan't be any trouble about that. I don't suppose you have any likely boys in mind for their places?"
"I do," he said, steeling himself. "If you please, the ones I brought from Africa."
De Manet had passed the weeks after their escape from Cape Town deep in delirium, with his side, where the bayonet had gone in, swelled out beneath the small, scabbed cut, as if an inflated bladder had sat beneath the skin, and Sifo, too distressed even to speak, refusing to leave the sick bed except to creep away and fetch water or gruel, which he patiently fed his brother spoon by spoon. The southern coast had slipped rapidly away to starboard, taking with it any hope of kin to whom they might have been returned, long before the ship's surgeon had informed Lawrence that the boy would make a recovery.
"It is to your credit, sir,"
Lawrence had said, even while wondering whatever was to be done with the boys now. By then the allegiance had seen Benguela, and there could be no question of turning back.
"It is no such thing," Mr. Ratcliffe had retorted. "A wound in the vitals of this sort is invariably fatal, or ought to be. There was nothing to be done but make him comfortable."
And he went away again, muttering, vaguely offended at having so obvious a diagnosis defied. The patient persisted in his defiance, making good proofs of the resilience of youth, and very shortly had reacquired the 2 stone of weight lost in his illness, and another for good measure. De Manet was dismissed the sick bay before they had crossed the equator, and the two were installed in the passenger quarters together, in a tiny, curtained-off compartment scarcely large enough to sling their 1 small hammock. The older boy's wariness would not permit them to sleep at the same time, and he insisted alternating watches. He was not without justification nervous of the general crowd of refugees from the Cape, who regarded the boys with simmering anger as representatives of the Kaffirs they blamed for the destruction of their homes. It was useless to try and explain to the settlers that De Manet and Sifo were of a wholly different nation than the one which had attacked them, and there was great indignation that the boys should be housed among them, particularly from the elderly shopkeeper and the farmhand, whose respective nooks had each been shortened by the width of 7 inches for their sake. A few quiet below-decks scuffles with the settler boys predictably followed. These ceased quickly, it becoming rapidly evident that a boy even lately ill, who had been for several years entirely dependent for his survival upon his own hunting skills, and by necessity forced to contend against lions and hyenas for his supper, was not an advisable opponent for boys whose experience ended at schoolyard squabbling. They resorted instead to the petty torments of smaller children, covert pinching and prodding, small, malicious traps of slush or filth left just beside the hammock, and the ingenious use of weevils. The third time Lawrence found the boys sleeping on the dragon deck, tucked up against Temeraire's side, he did not send them back to their small compartment below. Temeraire, being nearly their solitary point of familiarity, and the only one left among the company who had any grasp of their language whatsoever, quickly lost whatever lingering horrors he had possessed for them. The more so as they were sure in his company to avoid their tormentors. The boys were soon as apt to be clambering over his back in their games as any of the younger officers, and through his tutelage acquiring a reasonable command of English, so that a little while after they had left Cape Coast, Damani might come to Lawrence and ask, in a steady voice betrayed only by his hand clutching tightly at the railing, "Are we your slaves now?" Lawrence stared, shocked, and the boy added, "I will not let you sell Sifo away from me," defiantly, but with a note of such desperation as showed his understanding that he had not much power to defend himself or his brother from such a fate.
"No,"
Lawrence said at once. It was a dreadful blow to find himself regarded as a kidnapper.
"Certainly not. You are—"
But he was here stopped by the uncomfortable lack of any position to name, and forced to conclude, lamely,
"You are by no means slaves. You have my word you shall not be parted," he added.
Damani did not look much comforted.
"Of course you are not slaves,"
Temeria said in dismissive tones to rather better effect.
"You are of my crew,"
an assumption springing from his native possessiveness, which serenely made them his own in spite of all the obvious impracticality of such an arrangement, and forced Lawrence to recognize he could see no other solution, which should give them the respectability they might have earned among their own tribe for the services which they had performed. No one could have called them gentlemanlike in birth or in education, and Lawrence was dismally aware that while Sifo was a biddable, good-natured child, Damani was too independent, and more likely to be obstinate as a pig, if not belligerent, towards anyone wishing to effect an alteration in his manners. But difficulty alone could not be permitted to stand in the way. He had taken them from home, from all the relations which they might have, and robbed them of all standing in the world. If, at the end, there had been no practical way to restore them, he could not escape responsibility for the situation having arisen. He had wilfully contributed to it to the material benefit of the Corps and his mission. "Captains can choose whom they like. That has always been the way of it," Jane said. "But I will not say there shan't be a noise about it. You may be sure that as soon as the promotions are posted in the Gazette, I will be hearing from a dozen families. At present we have more likely boys trained up than places for them, and you have got yourself the reputation of a proper schoolmaster, even if they did not like to see their sprouts on a heavy weight. It is a pretty sure road to making lieutenant if they do not cut straps before then."
"I must surely give the greater weight," he said, "to those who have given so much in our service, and Temeraire already counts them as his own crew."
"Yes, but the carpers will say you ought to take them as personal servants, or at best ground crew," she said. "But damn them all, you shall have the boys, and if anyone complains of their birth, you may always declare them princes in their native country, without any fear of being proven false. Anyway," she added, "I will put them on the books, quietly, and we will hope they slip past. Will you let me give you a third? Temeraire's compliment allows for it."
He assented, of course, and she nodded.
"Good. I will send you Admiral Gordon's youngest grandson, and that will make him your best advocate, instead of your loudest critic. No one has as much time for writing letters and making noise as a retired admiral, I assure you."
Sifo was very willing to be pleased when informed of their elevation. Damani said a little suspiciously,
"We take messages and ride the dragon?"
"And other errands," Lawrence said, and was then puzzled how to explain errands, until Temeraire said,
"Those are small, boring things which no one very much likes to do,"
which did not reduce the suspicion.
"When will I have time to hunt?" the boy demanded.
"I do not suppose you will," Lawrence said, taken aback,
and only after a little more exchange gathered the boy did not realize that they would be fed and clothed, at Lawrence's expense, of course, as they had no family sponsoring them. Cadets drew no pay.
"You cannot think we would let you starve. What have you been eating so far?"
"Rats,"
Damani said succinctly, explaining belatedly to Lawrence's satisfaction the unusual lack of those delights more civilly referred to as millers, which had been much lamented among the midshipmen whose traditional prey they were.
"But now we are on land again. I took two of those small things last night,"
and gestured to make long ears.
"Not from the grounds of Dover Castle," Lawrence said.
Certainly there would not have been many of them nearer by, with the smell of so many dragons about.
"You must not again. You will be taken up for poaching."
He was not perfectly sure Damani was convinced, but at last Lawrence declared a private victory, and detailed the two of them to Roland and Dyer's supervision, to be led through their tasks a while.
It was a short flight only to the quarantine grounds, and the pavilion established to good effect in a sheltered valley, sacrificing prospect for a windbreak. It was not empty. Two rather thin and exhausted yellow reapers were sleeping inside, still coughing occasionally, and a limp little grayling, not Volley but Siloxia and her captain Meeks.
"On the Gibraltar route, I think," Meeks said to their inquiry. "If he has not been broken down again," rather bitterly. "I don't mean to carp at you, Lawrence. God knows you have done all you might, and more, but they seem to think at the Admiralty that it is like putting the wheel back on a cart, and they want us flying all the old routes again at once.
Halifax and back, by way of Greenland, and a transport, anchored in the middle of the North 50s, with ice water coming over the bow with every wave.
Of course she is coughing again."
He stroked the little dragon's muzzle. She sneezed plaintively. The floor was very comfortably warm, at least, and if the wood fire was a little smoky, worming up through the square stone slabs of the floor, the open plan blew the fumes away. It was a simple, practical building, not at all elegant or ornate, and Temeraire might have slept in it, but it could not have been called spacious on his scale. He regarded it with brooding disappointment, and was not disposed to linger. The crew did not even have the opportunity to dismount before he wished to be off again, putting the pavilion at his back and flying with rather a drooping ruff. Lawrence tried to console him by remarking on the sick dragons yet sheltering there, even in the summer's heat.
"Jane tells me that they would pile them in 10 at a time," he said, "during the winter, so wet and cold, and the surgeons are quite certain it saved a dozen lives."
Temeraire only muttered,
"Well, I am glad it has been useful,"
ungraciously. Such distant triumphs, achieved out of his sight and several months before, were not quite satisfactory.
"That is an ugly hill," he added, "and that one also. I do not like them."
Inclined to be displeased even with the landscape, when ordinarily he was mad for anything out of the common way, and would point out anything of the most meagre interest to Lawrence's attention with delight. The hills were odd. Irregular and richly covered with grass, they drew the eye queerly as they went overhead.
"Oh,"
said Emily suddenly on the forward lookout, craning her head over Temeraire's shoulder to look down at them, and shut her mouth hurriedly in embarrassment at the solecism of having spoken without a warning to give. Temeraire's wing beats slowed.
"Oh,"
he said. The valley was full of them. Not hills, but barrow mounds, raised over the dragon corpses where they had breathed their last. Here and there an outthrust horn or spike came jutting from the sod, or a little fall of dirt had bared the white curve of a jawbone. No one spoke. Lawrence saw Alan reach down and close his hands around the jingle of his carabiners, where they hooked on to the harness. They flew on silently above the verdant, deserted green, Temeraire's shadow flowing and rippling over the spines and hollows of the dead. They were still quiet when Temeraire came into the London covert, and the little unpacking necessary carried on subdued. The men carried the bundles to be stacked at the side of the clearing and went back for others. The harness men had none of their usual cheerful squabbling over who was to manage the belly netting, but in silence Winston and Porter went to it together.
"Mr. Ferris,"
Lawrence said, voice deliberately raised,
"when we are in reasonable order you may give a general leave through tomorrow dinner, barring any pressing duties."
"Yes, sir, thank you,"
Ferris said, trying to match his tone. It did not quite take, but the work went a little more briskly, and Lawrence was confident a night's revelry would soon finish the work of rousing the men out of the sense of oppression. He went and stood at Temeraire's head, putting his hand comfortingly on his muzzle.
"I am glad it was useful,"
Temeraire said, low, and slumped more deeply to the ground.
"Come, I would have you eat something," Lawrence said. "A little dinner, and then I will read to you, if you like."
Temeraire did not find much consolation in philosophy, or even mathematics, and he picked at his food, until, pricking up his ruff, he raised his head and put a protective forehand over his cow, and Volley came tumbling into the clearing, kicking up a furious hovering cloud of dust behind him.
"Temeraire!"
Volley said happily, and butted him in the shoulder, then immediately cast a wistful eye on the cow.
"Don't be taken in," James said, sliding down from his back. "Fed not a quarter of an hour ago, while I was waiting for the mails in Hyde Park, and a perfectly handsome sheep, too. How are you, Lawrence? Tolerably brown, I find. Here's for you, if you please."
Lawrence gladly accepted the parcel of letters for his crew, with one on top to his personal direction.
"Mr. Ferris," he said, handing the packet over to be distributed. "Thank you, James. I hope we find you well."
Volley did not look so bad as Meeks's report might have made Lawrence fear, if with a degree of rough scarring around the nostrils and a slightly raspy voice. It did not inhibit him from rambling happily on to Temeraire with an enumeration of the sheep and goats which he had lately eaten, and a recounting of his triumph at having sired early in the recent disaster an egg himself.
"Why, that is very good," Temeraire said. "When will it hatch?"
"November," Volley said delightedly. "He will say so," James said, "although the surgeons have no notion. It hasn't hardened a tick yet, and it would be early. But the blessed creatures do seem to know sometimes, so they are looking out a likely boy for the thing." They were bound for India. "Tomorrow, or the day after, maybe, if the weather keeps fair," James said airily. Temeraire cocked his head.
"Captain James, do you suppose that you might carry a letter for me? To China?" he added.
James scratched his head to receive such a request. Temeraire was unique among British dragons, so far as Lawrence knew, in writing letters. Indeed, not many aviators managed the habit themselves.
"I can take it to Bombay," he said, "and I suppose some merchantman is bound to be going on, but they'll only go to Canton."
"I am sure if they give it to the Chinese governor there, he will see it delivered," Temeraire said with justifiable confidence.
The governor was likely to consider it an imperial charge.
"But surely we ought not delay you for personal correspondence," Lawrence said a little guiltily,
if James did seem a little careless of his schedule.
"Oh, don't trouble yourself," James said. "I don't quite like the sound of his chest yet, and the surgeons don't either, as their lordships ain't disposed to worry about it, so neither am I about being quite on time. I'm happy enough to linger in port a few days and let him fatten himself up and sleep a while."
He slapped Volley on his flank and led him away to another clearing, the small grayling following on his heels almost like an eager hound, if a hound were imagined the size of a moderate elephant. The letter was from his mother, but it had been franked, a small but valuable sign of his father's approval of its having been sent, with replies to his last letter.
"We are very shocked by the news you send us from Africa, which in many respects exceeds that appearing in the papers, and pray for the solace of those Christian souls caught in the rack. But we do not repudiate some sentiment, which the abhorrence of such dreadful violence cannot wholly silence, that the wages of sin are not always held in arrears to be paid off on the day of reckoning, but malefactors, by God's will, may be held to account even in this earthly life. Lord Allendale considers it a judgment upon the failure of the vote. He is much satisfied by your account that the Tswana, if I have it correctly, might perhaps have been appeased by the ban, and we have hopes that this necessary period to that evil trade may soon lead to a better and more humane condition for those poor wretches who yet suffer under the yoke."
She concluded, more unfortunately, by saying,
"And I have taken the liberty of enclosing a small trinket which amused me to buy, but for which I have no use, as your father has mentioned to me that you have taken an interest in the education of a young lady, who I hope may find it suitable."
It was a fine string of garnets, set in gold. His mother had only one granddaughter, a child of 5, out of 3 sons, and now 5 grandsons, and there was a wistful note to be read between the closely written lines.
"That is very nice," Temeraire
said, peering over at it with an appraising and covetous eye, although it would not have gone once around one of his talons.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said sadly, and called Emily over to deliver the necklace to her.
"My mother sends it to you."
"That is very kind of her,"
Emily said, pleased, and if a little perplexed, quite happy to forego that sentiment in favour of enjoyment of her present. She admired it over her hands, and then thought a moment, and a little tentatively inquired,
"Ought I write to her?"
"Perhaps I will just express your thanks in my reply," Lawrence said.
His mother might not dislike receiving the letter, but it would only have encouraged the misunderstanding, and his father would certainly look with disfavour on any such gesture as suggesting expectations of a formal acknowledgement, no part of his sense of the responsibilities towards an illegitimate child, and there was no easy way to explain to him the perfect lack of foundation for such a concern. Lawrence was sadly puzzled how to write, even in his own letter, to avoid adding to the confusion, as he could not in civility omit the barest facts. that he had delivered the gift, seen it received, and heard thanks, all of which alone revealed that he had seen Emily very lately, and by the speed of his reply it would seem regularly. He wondered how he might explain the situation to Jane. He had the vague and slightly lowering thought that she would find it highly amusing, nothing to be taken seriously, that she would not at all mind being taken for, and here his pen stuttered and halted with his thoughts, because, of course, she was the mother of a child out of wedlock. She was not a respectable woman, and it was not only the secret of the call which would have prevented him ever making her known to his mother.
Chapter 15
"Jane," Lawrence said, "will you marry me?"
"Why, no, dear fellow," she said,
looking up in surprise from the chair where she was drawing on her boots.
"It would be a puzzle to give you orders, you know. If I had vowed to obey, it could hardly be comfortable. But it is very handsome of you to have offered," she added, and standing up kissed him heartily before she put on her coat.
A timid knock at the door prevented anything more he might have said. One of Jane's runners came to tell her the carriage was ready at the gates of the covert, and they had perforce to go.
"I will be glad when we are back in Dover. What a miserable swamp," Jane said,
already blotting her forehead on her sleeve as she left the small barracks house. The London setting added, to the attractions of stifling heat and the heavy moisture-laden air, all the city's unrivalled stench, and the mingling of barnyard scents with the acrid stink of the small covert's presently overburdened dragon middens. Lawrence said something or other about the heat and offered her his handkerchief mechanically. He did not know how to feel. The offer had come from some deeper impulse than conscious decision. He had not meant to speak, and certainly not yet, not in such a manner. An absurd moment to raise the question, almost as if he wished to be refused. But he was not relieved. He was by no means relieved.
"I suppose they will keep us past dinner-time," Jane said, meaning their lordships,
an opinion which seemed to Lawrence rather optimistic. He thought it very likely they should be kept for days if Bonaparte were not so obliging as to invade, with no warning.
"So I must look in on Exidium before we go. He ate nothing at all last night, nothing, and I must try and rouse him up to do better today." "I do not need to be scolded," Exidium murmured, without opening his eyes. "I am very hungry."
But he was scarcely able to rouse himself from his somnolence even to nudge briefly at her hand. Though, naturally, one of those earliest dosed with the supply of mushroom sent on by frigate from Cape Town, he was by no means yet fully recovered from his ordeal. The disease had been well advanced in his case by the time the cure had arrived, and only in the last few weeks had it been judged safe for him to leave the uncomfortable sand-pits which had made his home for more than a year. Nevertheless, he had insisted on managing the flight to London instead of letting Temeraire carry Jane with Lawrence, and was now paying for his pride with near prostration. He had done nothing but sleep since their arrival the afternoon before.
"Then try and take a little while I am here, for my comfort," Jane said,
and stepped back to the clearing's edge to keep her best coat and trousers from being spattered by the fresh butchered sheep, carried hurriedly over by the covert herdsman, and hacked apart directly in front of Exidium's jaws, which ground methodically away at the joints of meat as they were put in his mouth. Lawrence took the opportunity of escaping her company for a moment, and went to the neighbouring clearing, where Temeraire was busily engaged, despite the early hour, with his two sand-tables upon the letter. He was working upon an account of the disease, and its treatment, which he meant to send to his mother in China, with Mr. Hammond as his proxy, against the danger that a similar outbreak might one day there occur.
"You have made Long look more like Chi," he said severely,
casting an eye over the work of his coterie of secretaries, Emily and Dyer, who had been disgruntled to learn that their promotion to the exalted rank of ensign had not relieved them of all responsibility of schoolwork, and with them De Manet and Sifo, who were at least at no greater disadvantage learning Chinese scrip than anyone else would have been. Lawrence thought, abruptly, he might have asked her the other day, after they had disposed of the fate of the boys. They had been closeted alone together, without interruption, nearly an hour. That, at any rate, would have been a more opportune moment to speak, barring any scruple at introducing a subject so intimate in the precincts of her office. Or he might have spoken yesterday night, when they had left the dragons sleeping and retired together to the barracks house. Or, better still, he ought to have waited some weeks until the settling of this first furious bustle of activity after their arrival. hindsight serving powerfully to show him how he might better have forwarded the suit he had not wholly intended to make. Her rejection had been too practical, too quick, to give him much encouragement to renew his addresses under any future circumstances. In the ordinary way, he should have considered it as forming a necessary end to their relations, but the mode of her refusal made it seem mere petulance to be wounded, or to insist on some sort of moralizing line. Yet he was conscious of a lowering unhappiness. Perhaps in turning Catherine's advocate towards the state of matrimony, he had become his own, and without quite knowing had set his heart upon it, or at any rate his convictions. Temeraire finished his present line upon the sand-table, and lifting his foreleg away to let Emily carefully exchange it with the second, caught sight of Lawrence.
"Are you going?" he inquired. "Will you be very late?"
"Yes," he said, and Temeraire lowered his head and peered at him searchingly. "Never mind," Lawrence said, putting his hand on Temeraire's muzzle. "It is nothing. I will tell you later."
"Perhaps you had better not go," Temeraire suggested.
"There can be no question of that," Lawrence said. "Mr. Rowland, perhaps you will go and sit with Exidium this afternoon and see if you can convince him to take a little more food, if you please."
"Yes, sir. May I take the children?"
Emily said, from the advanced age of 12, meaning Damane and Sifo, the older of whom lifted his head indignantly at the name.
"I have been teaching them how to read and write in English in the afternoons,"
she added importantly, which filled Lawrence with anticipatory horror at the results of this endeavour, as Emily's penmanship most often resembled nothing more than snarled thread.
"Very good," he said, consigning them to their fate, "if Temeraire does not need them."
"No, we are almost finished, and then Dyer may read to me," Temeraire said. "Lawrence, do you suppose we have enough mushroom to spare that we may send a sample with my letter?"
"I hope so. Dorset tells me that they have managed to find a way to cultivate the thing in some caves in Scotland, so what remains need not all be preserved against future need," Lawrence said.
The carriage was old and not very comfortable, close and hot and rattling horribly over the streets, which were in any case none to the good this close to the covert. Chenery, so ordinarily irrepressible, was sweating and silent. Harcourt very pale, although this had a more prosaic cause than anxiety, and halfway along she was obliged in a choked voice to request they stop, so she might vomit into the street.
"There, I feel better,"
she said, leaning back in, and looked only a little shaky when she stepped down from the carriage and refused Lawrence's arm for the short walk through the courtyard into the offices.
"A glass of wine, perhaps, before we go in?" Lawrence said to her softly, but she shook her head.
"No, I will just take a touch of brandy,"
she said, and moistened her lips from the flask which she carried. They were received in the boardroom by the new First Lord and the other commissioners. The government had changed again in their absence over the question of Catholic emancipation, Lawrence gathered, and the Tories were in once more. Lord Mulgrave sat now at the head of the table, a little heavy by the jowls, with a serious expression and pulling a little at the end of his nose. The Tories did not think much of the corps under the circumstances. But Nelson was there also, and quite in defiance of the general atmosphere, he rose as soon as they had entered, and remained standing until in some embarrassment the other gentlemen at the table struggled to their feet. Then coming forward, he shook Lawrence's hand in the handsomest manner and asked to be presented.
"I am filled with admiration," he declared on being named to Catherine and making her a noble leg, "and indeed humbled, Captain Harcourt, on having read your account. I have been accustomed," he added, smiling, "to think a little well of myself and to like a little praise. I will be the first to admit it. But your courage stands above any example which I can easily recollect in a lifetime of service. Now, we are keeping you standing, and you must have something to drink."
"Oh, no, nothing," Catherine said,
so mortally crimson her freckles stood out as pale spots.
"Nothing, thank you, sir. And it was nothing, I assure you, nothing which anyone else would not have done, which my fellow officers did not do,"
she added, confusing her refusals of both refreshment and praise. Lord Mulgrave did not look entirely satisfied to have his precedence thus usurped. A chair had, of course, to be offered her, and perforce them all. Some shuffling ensued, so they were ranged together in a close row along the farther side of the table, with the naval lords facing them along the other. But still it did not quite have the court-martial quality of standing for interrogation. They went first through a tedious summation of events and a reconcilement of the accounts. Chenery had set down 10 days for the flight which had carried them prisoner to the falls. Lawrence had made it 12, Catherine 11, which difference consumed nearly an hour and required several maps to be dug out by the secretaries, none of which precisely agreed with one another on the scale of the interior.
"Sir, we would do better to apply to the dragons for our facts," Lawrence said finally, raising his head from the fourth of these, when they had only been able to agree conclusively that there had been a desert somewhere in the middle, and it had not been less than 9 days' flying.
"I will vouch that Temeraire is well able to judge distances in flight, and while they did not follow directly in our course, I am certain at least he can tell us where the borders of the desert are, which we crossed, and the larger of the rivers."
Mulgrave said, not encouragingly, stirring the report before him with a forefinger.
"Well, put it aside. Let us move to the matter of insubordination. I understand correctly, I believe, that all three beasts disregarded Captain Sutton's orders to return to Cape Town."
"Why, if you like to call it insubordination," Jane said, "it is a good deal more to the point that all three of them listened at all, and that they did not go herring off wild into the interior at once when they knew their captains stolen. A remarkable discipline, I assure you, and more than I would have looked for under the circumstances."
"Then I should like to know what else it is to be called," Lord Palmerston said from his seat further down. "A direct order disobeyed?"
"Oh!" Jane made half an impatient gesture with her hand. "Aborted. A dragon of 20 tons is not to be called to account by any means other than persuasion that I know of, and if they did not value their captains enough to disobey for them, they would not ever obey at all, so it is no use complaining. We might as well say that a ship is insubordinate, because it will not go forward when there is no wind. You can command the first as easily as the latter."
Lawrence looked down at the table. He had seen dragons enough in China who, without any captain or handler whatsoever, behaved with perfect discipline, to know her defence was flawed. He did not know a better name for it than insubordination himself, and was not inclined to dismiss it so lightly. It in some wise seemed to him more insulting than otherwise to suggest that the dragons did not know better. That Temeraire had known where his duty lay, Lawrence was quite certain. That Temeraire had disobeyed Sutton's orders wilfully, only because he did not like to follow them, was also certain. He as surely had considered that disobedience justified and natural, not even requiring of explanation, and would have been surprised to find anything else truly expected of him. But he would never have denied the responsibility. To draw such a fine point, however, before a hostile audience, perhaps inducing them to demand an irrational punishment, Lawrence did not deem prudent, even if he had been inclined to contradict Jane in such a setting. He was silent, while a brief wrestling over the question ensued, finished unresolved when Jane had said, "I am quite willing to lecture them on the subject, if you should like it, my lords, or put them to a court-martial, if that seems to you sensible and the best use of our time at present."
"For my part, gentlemen," Nelson said, "I think it cannot come as a surprise to those here when I say that victory is the best of all justifications, and to answer it with reproaches looks to me very ill. The success of the expedition proves its merit."
"A very fine success," Admiral Gambier said sourly, "which has left a crucial colony not merely lost but in ruins, and seen the destruction of every port along the coast of Africa, most notably meritorious."
"No one could have expected a company of 7 dragons to hold the African continent against a plague of hundreds under any circumstances," Jane said. "And we had better be grateful to have instead what intelligence we have gained from the successful recovery of our officers."
Gambier did not contradict her directly, but snorted, and went on to inquire about another small discrepancy in the reports. But as the session dragged on, it became gradually clear through his line of questioning and Lord Palmerston's that they meant to suspect that the prisoners had provoked the invasion deliberately, and subsequently had colluded to conceal the act. How they had gone about it was not to be specified, nor their motives, until at last Gambier added, in an ironical tone,
"And, of course, it is the slave trade to which they objected so violently, although, as everyone knows, the natives of the continent have made a practice of it from time immemorial, long preceding the arrival of Europeans on their shore. Or perhaps, I should say, of course, it is they who objected to the trade. I believe, Captain Lawrence, that you have strong views on the subject. I cannot be speaking out of turn to say so."
Lawrence said only,
"No, sir, you are not."
He offered no further remark. He would not dignify the insinuation with a defence.
"Have we nothing more pressing?" Jane said, "that we must spend our time on the possibility that a large company of officers arranged to have themselves abducted and a dozen good men killed so they could go and be offensive enough among a foreign nation where they did not speak a word to provoke them into assembling a dozen wings for immediate assault, which, I suppose, should have been accomplished overnight, for heaven knows there are no difficulties in providing support to 100 dragons?"
The questioning, with its grinding focus on minutiae, was sullenly given up in another hour when it had not provoked confession. There were no official grounds for court-martial, as no dragon had been lost, and if their lordships meant to seek a trial for the loss of the cape, it would have to be General Grey who faced it, and there was certainly no public sympathy for such an inquest. There was nothing left for them but to be deeply dissatisfied, and nothing left for Lawrence and his fellow captains but to sit and listen to their complaints. Several measures of recapturing the ports were proposed which had not the least chance of success, Jane forced to recall to their lordships, with poorly concealed exasperation, the parade of failures which had been occasioned by all the attempts to establish colonies in the face of organized aerial hostilities, by Spain in the New World, the total destruction of Roanoke, the disaster in Mysore.
"You should need enough ships to throw 20 tons of metal and 6 formations to take the Cape long enough to secure the fort again, if they have not ripped it all down," she said. "And when you are done, you should have to leave 2 of those formations behind with a first rate's worth of guns, and I hardly like to think how many soldiers, and somehow supply them monthly if the enemy did not have the bright notion of attacking the supply ships farther north."
The proposals subsided.
"My lords, you are already aware that I see no grounds to quarrel with Admiral Roland's figures," Nelson said. "If I am, perhaps, not so pessimistic of our chances to succeed where the attempts of a previous century had failed, but even half such a force cannot be easily mustered, and certainly not unobserved, nor could it be transported from any civilized port to any province of Africa without the knowledge of the navy, and indeed without its complaisance in the matter. I will stand surety for it. If we cannot retake the Cape, therefore, or re-establish a foothold upon the continent, we may nevertheless satisfy ourselves that no other nation may do so. France certainly cannot aspire to it. I will not say that Napoleon may not conquer any place in the world from Calais to Peking so long as he can walk to it, but if he must put to sea, he is at our mercy. Indeed," he added, "I will go further. Without in any way ceasing to lament the dreadful loss we have suffered in property and lives from the savagery of this unprovoked assault, I will, as a question of strategy, declare myself heartily content to exchange all the convenience of our possession of the Cape for the lack of any need to defend that position henceforth. We have spoken before, gentlemen, in these halls, of all the expense and difficulty of improving the fortifications and patrolling the vast coastline against French incursion, an expense and difficulty which will now be borne instead by our erstwhile enemies."
Lawrence was by no means disposed to argue with him, but he could not comprehend at first why the Admiralty should have feared such an incursion at all. The French had never shown the least ambition to seize the Cape, which, if a valuable port in general, was unnecessary to them, holding as they did the Île-de-France off the eastern coast of Africa, and certainly a difficult nut to crack. They had enough to do to hold what maritime possessions they already had. Mulgrave pulled at his nose a little, without comment.
"Admiral Roland," he said at last, reluctantly, as if he did not like to pronounce her title, "what is our present strength at the Channel, if you please?"
"From Falmouth to Middlesbrough, 83 I put at fighting strength," she said, "and another 20 who could rise to the occasion, 17 of those heavyweight and 3 longwings, besides the Kazalik and the Celestial. At Lochlagan we have another 14, hatchlings, in training, but old enough to bring up, and more, of course, along the North Sea coast. We would be hard put to feed them for an action of more than a day, but they would make a good relief."
"What is your estimation of our chances? Should he make another attempt to invade by means of airships, such as he used at the Battle of Dover?" Nelson asked.
"If he don't mind leaving half of them on the ocean floor, he might be able to land the rest, but I shouldn't recommend it to him," Jane said. "The militia will set them on fire as quick as they can come in past us. No, I asked for a year, and it has not been so long, but the cure makes up for all that, and having back Lily and Temeraire in fighting trim, the French cannot come by air."
"Yes, the cure," Nelson said. "It is, I trust, secured. There is no chance it might be stolen. I believe I heard of an incident—"
"Why, I beg you will not blame the poor fellow," Jane said. "He is a lad of 14, and his Winchester was in a bad way. There are some sorry rumours, I am afraid to say, that there was not enough of the cure to go about,
because we began a little slowly to see how small the dose might be kept before we ran around pouring it down their gullets. There was no harm done, and he confessed it all himself quite rightly when I put it to all the captains. We put a guard on the supply afterwards to keep anyone else from temptation, and no one has gone poking about. "But if another attempt should be made," Nelson said, "might the guard be easily increased and perhaps some fortification arranged?" After feeding every blessed dragon in Britain and the colonies on the stuff, there is precious little of it left to steal if anyone should want to, Jane said, except what the gentlemen of the Royal Society have managed to persuade to take root up at Loch Laggan. And as for that, if anyone likes to try and take it from the middle of a covert, they are welcome. Very good. So, gentlemen, Nelson said, turning to the other commissioners, you see that as a result of these events, deplorable as they may be in themselves, we may now be quite certain in our control of the cure, at least as certain as our own efforts could have made us.
I beg your pardon,
Lawrence said, making sense at last he thought of the preoccupation, and with dismay.
Is there reason to believe the disease has been communicated to the continent? Are the French dragons taken ill?
We hope so, Nelson said, although we yet lack confirmation upon the point. But the spy courier, the plan vite, whom we captured, was sent over to them 2 days ago, and we hope any day to receive word that they have been inoculated with the disease.
The only damned silver lining to the bloody mess, Gambier said, to a general murmur of agreement. It will be some reparation to see the Corsican's face when his own beasts are all coughing blood.
Sir, Lawrence managed. Beside him Catherine was sickly wan with horror, the back of her hand pressed to her mouth.
Sir, I must protest against—
He felt as though he were choking. He remembered little Sauvignon, who had kept Temeraire company that long, dreadful week, when they thought all hope was lost, when Lawrence had expected to see his dragon coughing blood at any moment. "I should damn well hope so," Jane said, standing up. "This is why you had her sent to Eastbourne, I suppose, and none of closing the quarantine grounds at all. A splendid creeping business. Will we be driving a plague ship into their harbour next, pray tell me, or poisoning their convoys of grain? Like a parcel of damned scrubs!" Musgrave, straightening outraged in his chair, snapped,
"Ma'am, you are out of order!"
And Admiral Gambier said,
"This is what comes of—"
"Why, damn you, Gambier, come around here and say so," she said, putting her hand to her sword, and the room devolved very quickly to shouting and scorn, so even the marines outside the door put in their heads timidly.
"You cannot mean to do this,"
Lawrence said.
"Your Grace! You have met Temeraire, spoken to him. You cannot imagine they are not thinking creatures, beasts to be put to the slaughter."
Palmerston said, "Tender-hearted, womanish folly," seconded by Gambier and Ward. "The enemy," Nelson said over the noise, trying to reply, "and we must seize the opportunity which has been offered us to level the distinction between our aerial forces and theirs." The sly, underhanded way it had all been managed proved well enough that the commissioners had expected opposition, and chosen to avoid it. They were not more ready to be harangued after the fact, and when Jane had shortly grown a little louder, they had reached the limits of their tolerance.
"And this," Jane was shouting, "is how I am told, days past the event, when the stupidest scuttling crab might conceive that, as soon as Bonaparte knows what has happened, as soon as he sees his beasts growing sick, he will come across at once. At once! He is not a gaping fool. And you drag me here to Dover with two long wings that are celestial, and the damned channel hanging open like Rotten Row,"
when Musgrave, rising, beckoned to the guards to stand open the door.
"Then we must not keep you,"
he said rather icily, and added when Jane would have gone on,
"You are dismissed, madam,"
holding out the formal orders for the defence of the channel, the papers crumpling savagely in Jane's fist as she stormed out from the room. Catherine leaned heavily on Chenery's arm as they left, pale with her lip bitten to dark red. Nelson, following, stopped Lawrence in the hall before he could go far after them, with a hand to his arm, and spoke to him at length. About what, Lawrence did not entirely follow. A cutting-out expedition which he proposed to make to Copenhagen, the Danish fleet to be seized there.
"I would be glad to have you, Captain," he finished, "and Temeraire, if you could be spared from the defence of the Channel, at least for a week's time."
Lawrence stared at him, feeling heavy and stupid, baffled at Nelson's easy manner. He had met Temeraire, had spoken with him. He could not plead ignorance. He might not have been the prime mover of this experiment, but he was no opponent of it, whose opposition might have been everything, would have been everything, surely.
The silence grew strained, then oppressive. Nelson paused, said with a little more hauteur,
"You are fresh from a long voyage, and I am sure tired from all this questioning. I have considered it an unnecessary waste from the first. We will speak again tomorrow. I will come to the covert in the morning, before you must return."
Lawrence touched his hat. There was nothing he could say. Out of the building and into the street, sick to his heart and wretched, seeing nothing. The touch on his elbow made him startle, and he stared at the small, shabby man standing next to him. The expression Lawrence wore must have shown some sign of what he felt. The small man bared a mouthful of wooden teeth in an attempt at a placating smile, thrust into Lawrence's hand a packet of papers, and touching his own forelock, dashed away without a word spoken. Mechanically, Lawrence unfolded it. A suit for damages in the amount of £10,300, 206 slaves valued at £50 a head. Temeraire was asleep in the lingering, slanted light, dappled. Lawrence did not wake him, but sat down on the rough-hewn log bench beneath the shelter of the pine trees facing him, and silently bent his head. In his hands he turned over the neat roll of crisp rice paper, the seal in red ink already affixed, which Dyer had handed him. The letter could not be allowed to go, he supposed. Too much chance of interception, or that the intelligence might find its way back, somehow, to Lien, if she yet retained any allies in the Chinese court. The clearing was empty, the men still out on their leave. From the small forge, past the trees, Blythe's hammer steadily rang on the harness buckles, a thin metallic sound exactly like the odd voice of the African bird calling along the river, and Lawrence found the dust of the clearing suddenly thick in his nostrils, the new copper smell of blood and dirt vividly recalled, of sour vomit. He had the strong sensation of rope pressing into the skin of his face, and he rubbed his hand uneasily over his cheek as if he might find a mark there, though they had all faded. There was nothing more than a little roughness, perhaps, an impression of the corded rope left upon the skin. Jane joined him after a little while, her fine coat discarded, and her neckcloth also. There were bloodstains on her shirt. She sat down on the bench and leaned forward, mannish, with her elbows braced against her knees, her hair still plaited back, but the finer strands about the face wisping free.
"May I beg a day's leave of you?"
Lawrence asked eventually.
"I must see my solicitors in the city. I know it cannot be long."
"A day,"
she said. She chafed her hands together absently, though it was not cold in the least, even with the sun making its last farewells behind the barracks house.
"Not longer."
"Surely they will keep her quarantined,"
Lawrence said, low.
"Her captain saw our own quarantine grounds. He must have realized she was taken ill as soon as he saw her. He would never expose the other dragons."
"Oh, they thought it out with both hands, never fear," Jane said. "I have had the account of it now. He was sent home by boat. She was let to see him off from a distance and told that he had been sent to the covert outside of Paris, where the mail couriers nest. I dare say she flung herself directly into their ranks. Oh, what a filthy business! But now it has been well spread, I am sure. The couriers go every quarter of an hour, and new come in as often."
"Jane," Lawrence said, "Napoleon's couriers go to Vienna. They go to Russia and to Spain, and all through Prussia. The Prussian dragons themselves are penned in French breeding grounds. Our allies, whom we deserted in their hour of need, they go even to Istanbul, and from there where will the disease not be carried?"
"Yes, it is very clever,"
she said, smiling, with a parchment thinness to the corners of her mouth.
"The strategy is very sound. No one could argue with it. At a stroke we go from very nearly the weakest aerial force in Europe to the strongest."
"By murder," Lawrence said. "It can be called nothing else. Wholesale murder."
Nor was there any reason why the devastation should end in Europe. All the maps over which he had laboured through their half-year's journey home from China unfolded again for him without any need for their physical presence. The wavering course of their journey now made a track for slow, creeping death to run along in reverse. Strategy. Strategy would call it a victory to see the Chinese aerial legions decimated. Without them, the Chinese infantry and cavalry could hardly stand against British artillery. The distant corners of India brought under control, Japan humbled, perhaps a sick beast might be delivered to the Inca, and the fabled cities of gold flung open at last.